This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We associate, it seems, the Kankakee River and to a little lesser extent, although not much, the Yellow River that runs to the east of Lake County in Porter and other counties with the flooding problems. And Kankakee in particular, there isn't a time that you don't seem to go down U.S. 41 headed to Shelby or to Samava Resorts and points to the south into from Lake into Newton County without seeing the river just barely underneath the bridge. And that's because that the whole area is, of course, very low. The flooding is common, and in fact, last year it got rather historic in some respect. That is why there are some major changes that state lawmakers realized after last year's flooding that they really needed to do something serious to try to resolve the problem. And that is why our guest here in the studio is talking about his job as the executive director of the commissions to be able to help handle the problem with flooding. Scott Pelath, I guess the short definition of your job is executive director of, I guess, what is going to be the Kankakee River Basin Commission.
Actually, Chris, it will be in statute, the Kankakee River Basin and Yellow River Basin Development Commission.
Yeah, it's a very long name. Now, find a way to pare that down, I know.
That's right. Yeah. As I mentioned to you off the air, that'll be one of our first duties is to come up with a workable name.
Let's take some time to do a little history lesson here. We probably people have never really known that the problems that have lied upon the Kankakee River in particular that people get to see virtually every day or they live around it go back into the 19th century. In fact, the land was such that basically that I understand that the watershed was the second largest in the country.
That's correct, Chris. And by the way, it's great to be here with you today to talk about this very important topic, but one that has a lot of exciting and compelling changes ahead. The Grand Kankakee Marsh was once the second largest freshwater marsh in the United States. And beginning in the 19th century and ending in World War I, there were massive drainage projects that were undertaken by state government and by the local governments. And the reason was pretty basic. They exposed some of the most productive farmland in the world. You know, and this farmland is now a key part of our economy. It's an important component of our tax base for public services here in this region. And it allowed the development of a number of important and historic communities here in the area. But we're still living with the consequences of it. Because the underlying topography and geology still has this tendency to create marsh-like effects. So we have to deal with the implications of that, because certainly we have many eggs in the economic basket with respect to these long-ago decisions, and then we have the human factors. And then we have the quality of life issues that remain with us as well. So the state legislature has finally taken very substantive steps to try to deal with the implications of these things that are really 100 years in the making.
When the first commissions, I guess, or actually the whatever predated the commissions,
right,
came about here back in the early 20th century after the big dredging project of 1918, that finished up, you say, 1919. Was there anything that was set up at that time that you know of in looking through the history books to try to find some way to come up with a plan to deal with all of these problems that came about from all that that marshland?
Here's what happened. Yeah. You have eight counties that basically comprise the Kankakee River Basin. And I'll rattle them off as I did before. St. Joe, Marshall, LaPorte, Stark, Porter, Jasper, Lake, and Newton.
And that's actually the way it starts, because it starts in South Bend and moves west.
That's how I name them off.
Yeah.
What happened was is that each county would just battle the river on its own. They would do what seemed to make sense from their own parochial perspective. But there was a tragedy of the commons that happened. Every county sort of acted in its own self-interest, and as a result, we wound up with a worse result for everybody. You know, more flooding, more erosion, more difficulties for agriculture and communities. So in the late 1970s, the Kankakee River Basin Commission was formed by the state legislature. And that's where the process of trying to coordinate drainage policies began. You still had local counties paying for their share of it, but there was some forum to try to get everyone to work in concert. To their credit, that commission got us to the present day, And in tandem with the Chris, it was a record flood in 2018. It was a record at two gauges. In tandem with the increase in precipitation and major flood events and the work of the commission previously, it sort of got the state government to the point where they were willing to make long-term investments in our region to deal with these longstanding problems.
Since the flooding, I guess, is when the real serious work on a long-range plan has gotten underway. Tell us what the project is like right now, and
sure.
Hopefully when will those who will make decisions about this plan will get to see it?
Last year, the state legislature released funds to the Kankakee River Basin Commission and directed that those funds be used to come up with a long-term work plan. And Christopher Burke Engineering was employed to come up with the work plan. It has been presented in draft forms to the commission as it exists now, and we're expecting a draft final report really in another few weeks, mm-hmm. which will then be handed off to the new commission to begin in earnest some of the long-term efforts that are going to need to be undertaken. What this report is going to contain are a couple of key components. One, we have unimaginable amounts of sediment that keep entering the system. The glaciers dump sand in this part of the world. There are sand dunes in Marshall County and in Stark County where the Yellow River originates. There are sand banks up and down the Kankakee. And what happens is there's more water entering the system, as we do have both for natural reasons and for human reasons, the amount of erosion is increasing. So you have all this glacial sediment still clogging up the Yellow River and clogging up the Kankakee, and it shouldn't be any surprise when you add more water to that, you have more flood events and more water going where it's not beneficial to humans. So we have to begin by mitigating sediment, keeping sediment from coming out of the Yellow River. We have to begin by stabilizing our banks along the Kankakee. And we have to begin the process of deciding how we're going to manage the water that's currently there. One final thing, we also have to learn how to work with our neighbors in Illinois to solve this problem as well, because that is where the Kankakee ends up. It's a tributary of the Illinois River. So this commission will also be tasked with partnering with the state of Illinois, so we're working in concert.
When the commission was founded, I know that since you had several counties, all these counties involved in this one way or the other, and these all had to, I guess, get their own way to their own funding, that is, to get this work done that they could do. They got some nominal help, I understand, from the state government, but it never seemed to be enough to be able to do much, was it?
Yeah, and not only was it not enough, and there were some years where, it might be $1 million. There were other years where maybe it was $600,000. When you talk about 122 miles of river, that just doesn't go very far. In addition, is that the commission at the time would never know whether it was going to have funds in the future. So then the natural inclination is to, be very careful with the funds that you're using, do it more for things like pilot projects and studies and maybe things that can help educate the public about solutions going forward. But now there's a commitment to, regional long-term funding. So we have we'll have the capability in the future to make substantial change for longstanding problems.
Now, the measure that the General Assembly passed here this past session not only changes the makeup of the commission itself, but it also adds in that funding issue, and it gives at least the opportunity to have something that is more permanent, it seems, and certainly more reliable, is it not, having this actual assessment procedure?
That's right. As constructed, it will be a long-term funding stream, and it'll be a reliable one. So you can make a plan and then have an idea of how you're going to put that plan into action.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's important to remember, because it'll be funded for assessments on parcels within the basin, is they contribute water to the system. Some of the amounts are rather nominal, about $3.50 a bill for, if you're a residential parcel owner. Working in concert with the Indiana Farm Bureau, an amount was determined to be a dollar a farm acre. in order to consolidate these resources and be able to do the long-term projects, which will benefit everybody. I think the important thing to remember is that we're paying for it now.
Yeah.
You know, we pay for it in property damage. We pay for it in reduced property values. We pay for it in erosion of the tax base. But what we've done up to this point is pay for problems, and now we have the opportunity to be in paying for solutions, and that's a demarcation.
Was that something that came as, I'm sure, lately at least, was a result of last year's flooding? Was there so much damage, so many people that were affected personally, as well as farmers that had their land affected by the flooding, so it got to actually see personally, and for some people, as I say, firsthand, what the flooding situation has come to these days.
That's correct, and that's where I, you know, just having served with a number of these lawmakers in the past and knowing what their perspective was, they just simply became determined that they needed to do something, that what we were doing by sort of kicking the can down the road and not making commitment to long-term solutions was exacting real costs on the people of the region.
With the procedure now set up and the new commission to be created here in the months ahead, and you say also, too, you get to see the first draft, the final report of the long-range plan that the engineers have been all working on very hard for the last few months. What is going to be the makeup of the new commission? Because we have a commission now that, at least up to this point, is 24 members. It represents three people from every county in the area, and it's going to get pared down to only nine.
It'll be pared down to nine. There'll be one member appointed by the county commission of each county. One facet that I'm excited about, though, is that the ninth member will be either the director of the Indiana Department of Natural Resources or his or her designee.
Mm-hmm.
The advantage there is we know that regulators have a major role in the type of work that needs to be done, and I think there's immense value in having an important regulator being the DNR formally involved from the get-go. That way, we know if we're risking running afoul of state, local, and federal rules, that we're engaged in that process from the very beginning and aren't moving off into directions that aren't going to be fruitful in the long term.
Now, I have to ask, when you have a commission that was so populated with all these people from all the counties, and you have to trim it down from 24 to 9, what's been the reaction here to the changes that are going to come about here to this much smaller commission?
That's an excellent question, Chris. You have people on the current commission who have just poured their hearts and souls into the river and care about it very deeply. I think there is a realization, though, that if there is going to be a commitment to funding, that office is going to bring about governance structure changes. That's not uncommon. That happens frequently. And I think many people ultimately believed and supported the fact that the most important thing to do was the work. And as long as we're doing the work, who's involved from year to year in terms of decision making, that's okay. We can have it's about the outcomes. It's about the outcomes.
Any idea when the last big official meeting is going to be of the now existing commission?
That's right. The final meeting of the Kankakee River Basin Commission will be on June 13th, and that's the commission is currently comprised. And we generally meet either in Knox or North Judson, because it's a good central location between, you know, cutting across two time zones. But I'm hopeful, and it's my tentative plan, that the new commission will convene sometime in early July.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my task at the moment is to make sure that we have a smooth transition between two different governance structures.
Well, Scott Pilat, thank you for joining us to talk about this. It's a big project, as big as the river basin itself of the Yellow and the Kankakee Rivers, to be sure, and trying to deal with the historic flooding that seems like it's always happened along that part of Lake County and surrounding counties as well, too. So we'll see what happens and how the commission that will be taking over the summer will be doing, and also, too, to find out more about that long-range plan that everybody will have a chance to take a look at and see what can be done to deal with the problems and the benefits that come from living along or in the Kankakee and the Yellow River basins. Thanks for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Scott Pilat is the executive director of what is for now known as the Kankakee River Basin Commission, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This month is Mental Health Awareness Month here in Indiana and across the country, and we're looking in particular about the concerns about child mental health, and for that, we turn to Tammy Silverman. She's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Hi, Tammy. Thanks for joining us today.
Always my pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
Well, tell us more about the concerns that the IYI has and some new information that's out here about the state of child mental health these days.
Right. There is a new study that just came out earlier this year from JAMA Pediatrics that talks about one in every six children across the country have at least one mental health disorder. And so rather than, you know, understanding that this is a common thing, this is something that a lot of our kids are dealing with, and so it's important for us to know that and also know what some of those signs are and how we can help.
Are they, some of these points that have come up in the report and that you all discovered with IYI in a way related to what you have found out in the Kids Count report that's come out here about the status of young people in Indiana, in particular the problems they have at home, whether it's environment or whether it's medical issues or things like that, that they all have a link somehow or another to their mental health status?
They do, you know, and I think you're absolutely right. So in Indiana, we know that last year, 11.6% of Hoosier children received treatment or counseling from a mental health professional. 5.2% of Indiana kids have been diagnosed with depression. 11% have also been diagnosed with anxiety. So again, this is something that's pretty common. It happens across the board, and I think it's important for us to not only think about physical things that kids are dealing with, be that allergies or asthma or diabetes, but also think about what are the mental health conditions that many, many of our kids, such as anxiety, depression, and ADHD, are the most common that many of our kids are dealing with.
In looking over this report that you got here from JAMA and taking a look at how it's going to break out for the status of Indiana young people, what kind of points do we need to pass along to parents, to caregivers, to schools and other institutions that have contact every day with young people here in Indiana? What can they do to help the young people out?
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, it's most often our teachers, coaches, mentors, and family members that see some of these signs. So it's really understanding what some of those symptoms are. So for young children, some of the symptoms are intense worry or fear. You know, oftentimes little kids get over things pretty quickly, but if your child is intensely worried or fearful, that's something to pay attention to. Frequent tantrums, complaints about constant stomach or headaches where there's no known medical cause, or a lack of interest in playing with other children their age. Right. And those things, I think some of the challenges that we hear from family members are that some of these behaviors are normal. Some days kids are, you know, they just don't want to deal with any other kids, and that may be normal. These conditions, however, if they last over a period of time, that's where we need to pay closer attention.
Mm-hmm. If anything comes out of all of this, I suppose, is with the reports that you get in on a regular basis and the information you get from the field and from members of the IYI staff that have contact with the school leaders, with the school counselors and other people as well, too. Are we finding maybe more ways that we're able to come up with new ways, if necessary, to help young people try and cope with all the problems that they're facing?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's really important that we identify these challenges at a young age. Most mental health disorders start before the age of 14, and there's still kind of that perception that maybe this is happening because of poor parenting, or maybe the kids just need to buckle down and trudge through it, that kind of thing. But in reality, this is a physiological issue, and so we need to pay attention to that, and we're getting better at doing that, which is wonderful. But again, intervening quickly and understanding that most of these childhood mental health disorders are episodic rather than permanent. So just like a physical illness, the key is really to making sure that we're screening appropriately and then getting the treatment that's needed for whatever the particular illness is.
And we take time here talking about the mental health status of Indiana's young people. There's another area, too, that I know that the Indiana Youth Institute keeps a close eye on is how to get young people ready for advanced education. In fact, I know on June 5th and 6th in Indianapolis is going to be another college and career conference coming up here. Can you fill us in on what the 2019 event's going to be like and more information if anybody wants to sign up for it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's still some, you know, it is filling up quickly, but there is there are still spots open. So thank you for bringing that up. Our College and Career Conference has been going on for about a decade, and it's one of those unique times that school counselors, as well as educators and after-school providers, all come together to learn some of those new techniques that are out there, new research, but also have conversations on how do we address some of the issues we're seeing. This year, we're bringing in the Department of Education as well as the Department of Workforce Development, which both have new programs and training requirements. So we're hoping to give it kind of a one-stop shop. So if you show up, you can get the training you need from DWD, DOE, and also connect with your peers and make sure that all of our kids have a pathway beyond high school, whatever that may be. And that could be an apprenticeship, it can be a certification, two-year college, or four-year college.
Where is this year's event going to happen?
It's on the north side of Indianapolis, so you don't have to come all the way downtown, which I know sometimes is a challenge for folks. So it's really up on the north side. It saves you about 30 minutes, and all the information is at iyi.org.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned it here, but we've kind of alluded to the problem that they've been doing a lot of reconstruction or at least repairs on sections of I-65 and I-70. And
absolutely.
Yeah, this has not been easy, so it's good to have a facility north that works out well for this type of event coming up with the College and Career Conference. To be sure. If anybody is interested in those spaces that are still available, if they're interested, how can they find out more and to register?
You just go to iyi.org and there's a button for the conferences and click on register, and it'll also give you all the information about who some of those keynote speakers are. And again, I know this year there's a big emphasis on social emotional well-being because that's what our counselors, teachers, and after-school providers said is really important to making sure these kids can have that long-term success.
Well, Tammy, thanks for your info, and thanks for the chance to talk a little bit here about some of the concerns that IYI has during this Mental Health Awareness Month that's underway right now across Indiana and the rest of the nation. And we'll talk to you again real soon.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, Chris.
You're welcome. Tammy Silverman's president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Lake County's Solid Waste Management District has set up a number of drop-off centers for folks who live in the county who don't have a local drop-off service, or they don't have actually curbside recycling service available to them to be able to bring their recyclables, and it'll in turn, with the hope at least, that it would go to the homes and where it needs to be reprocessed, turned back into product again for another use. But sometimes things happen, and it seems that lately that there have been more bad things happening than good. With us to talk about the state of the recycling issues here in Lake County, we have Jeanette Romano, who is the Executive Director of the Lake County Solid Waste Management District. And with her, we also have Kira Hagerman. She is the Education and Public Information Programs Manager. And ladies, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Well, we talk here about the benefits of recycling. It's touted and has been for years about the importance of properly recycling. And we know there have been issues in the last few years. In fact, Neil Samahan, when he was still with Metro Recycling, spent a lot of time talking with us about that, about the changes when China decided to ban the accepting of recyclables coming from the United States. That's kind of threw everything into the real mix here. And we start to see, I'm sure, some problems here at home. Tell us first a little bit about the impact of what's happened overseas and how it affects Lake County, Indiana.
Well, that's true, Chris. That has affected the haulers, which trickles down to affect all of our citizens here in Lake County and how they recycle, because what they recycle goes to the haulers. The haulers then tries to market it and send it to China, and it gets rejected. Of course, you know, China's not taking anything except the cardboard right now, so that's the big issue. They're getting what residents are doing is wishful recycling. If they find something that's plastic, they're recycling it. It might not be something that's recyclable. If they're putting trash into their recycling container, well, now they're getting trash getting sent to other countries, and that's what's caused the problem. China got a lot of trash sent to them, and so their environmental department is trying to clean up their country.
I know the major problems here in Lake County of recent months, in fact, even as recently as this month, have turned out to be in a brand new drop-off center that was set up here in Lake County. Only been open, about three years, I guess, when it was finally had the grand opening, so to speak. But now it's had to close up. Tell us the problems that have happened with the Lake County Government Center and how it all seems to fit together with the overall problem we have in trying to do the right thing to recycle, to save the planet, the other things that we always talk about, but also, too, to be able to provide responsible materials that can go off and be reused.
Well, Chris, that is the third center that the district has placed in the city of Crown Point. And we thought placing it there at the government center would be a deterrent from illegal dumping. And it started out very well. But the past year and a half, I would say, it has just escalated. We went from a 3-day collection there at that center to a 5-day collection. And not only did our contractor waste management have a team go out 2 days a week to maintain the site, but we learned that the government center had a team that cleaned up the site every day, especially on Mondays after a heavy illegal dumping. So we were getting mattresses and just loads. A very nice lady called me yesterday and asked where the center went. She wasn't upset, but she said she went there one day. There was a mattress there. She took a piece of paper and she wrote on it, "This is the kind of things that will end this center for us." And she said she had been there one time where there were 4 loads. She said it looked like somebody had just dumped 4 truckloads of material. And she said she felt sorry for whoever had to clean that up, because that she said it never made it in the containers. It was just dumped on the ground.
No.
And so it's not good fiscal use of taxpayer dollars to keep paying for cleaning up and landfilling when it's supposed to be meant for recycling.
Well, in fact, I was going to ask you next, what is the financial ramifications of this? Because if the material was clean and was well sorted in the containers where they were supposed to go, at least that the waste management trucks could come by and pick up the containers and take the material off to be processed and reused again, hopefully. But here you've got this big, massive trash, basically. So you say it all ends up getting scooped up and it ends up going into a trash truck, and then it ends up going to the landfill, which is outside of Lake County.
And when we do have the illegal dumping there and waste management has to send a separate truck, they do bill us for that. And over the last year and a half, we've been analyzing every month how much of our costs go to actual recycling and how much of the cost is due to contamination and overage, and we got to about 30% that was a contamination and overage cost of our total bill. 30% of it was contamination.
Now, how does this problem that's cropped up with this new center, again, another one set up in Crown Point, how does this compare to some of the other drop-off centers that you have set up in other locations around the county?
Seems like a lot of it was cyclical, mm-hmm. and one would get better for a while, And then it would go downhill, and we would maybe place new bins one place to try to help. And that would be good for a while, but then it would go downhill again. So we had anywhere from probably 5% contamination up to 35% contamination at the other locations around the county.
Now, I know in the letter that you got from the Lake County Commissioners explaining the situation, which I'm sure you were very much aware of course, but the making it more official, their request that the drop-off center be closed, the containers removed, and the area cleaned up. I guess they were very nice. They thanked you for the efforts to bring more recycling options to Lake County, but it's a thanks, but what's the next step going to be, or can there be a next step, I suppose?
Well, we're thinking about that. You know, recycling is right, and it is a good thing to do, and we do need to reduce our waste going to the landfills. That is our mission, and so we're going to be thinking about this, Chris. We don't know what the best option is. It certainly is not an unmanned drop-off center, because you're going to get those people to come in there and illegally dump their mattresses, their construction material, their couches, their TVs, their computers. They're moving all their items because they're moving, their paint, their tires. There are places that the district has throughout the county for those types of materials. And we are trying to also keep the public educated on how to properly recycle those materials and where to take them. The drop-off centers were not the places to take them. Today, in Cherryville, there's a container. It has 6 tires inside of it.
Oh, my goodness.
When they can take, and the container is right next to the public works facility, where they can take their tires right to the public works facility.
I know that there's always been some areas that have had historically had problems. I'm sure there are probably areas in South Lake County, but we know in particular in North Lake County, there have always been problems in some of the roads that are in the city of Gary on the west edge in some of the open areas. And, of course, there used to be a landfill out that way, too, that's gotten covered over the years. But there's still a lot of dumps that's always been set up out there, and you see a lot of people dumping material on the roadside, too. So it's a problem that apparently is never going to go away, but we have to figure out how to deal with it, don't you?
Yes.
If you have the situation where you've now lost another drop-off center, you're trying to figure out what the next option is going to be, I guess it may seem simplistic in saying so, but what can we tell people as they're listening to our conversation as ways to be able to help deal with the situation of not only helping to recycle properly, but also deal with this trash load that's being dumped on the public?
Well, we do have a pretty extensive website where residents can go and learn where to recycle all sorts of materials. As Jeanette mentioned, we have resources for tires and electronics and where you can take your paint, but we also have all the little things where batteries can go, things like that. So if we can get the word out to educate the public on where to take the material properly, and we have our household hazardous waste collections where all that material can come, that's a really good start. But people need to be willing to take the time to dispose of their material properly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if one neighbor can tell another neighbor, hey, this is where we go for this, and then that can spread, that's where we're hoping that this can go.
Have you had a chance to talk with some of your neighbors, I mean, so to speak, the neighboring solid waste operations and the solid waste management districts of Porter County, for example? I know that they've had the similar type of problem with one of their drop-offs in Valparaiso, that they've had to, I guess, to change out containers to a special kind of container that helps restrict what you can put in it. Is that an option that Lake County Solid Waste District can go through?
We actually did have some of the new containers placed at the government center,
mm-hmm.
had some locking lids, and probably within a month, the locking lids were broken. So that did not help at Crown Point. We also had some new retrofitted containers at the Munster drop site, where you would have to flatten your cardboard and put cardboard in the front, and then there was a hole in the side for smaller recyclables, Tide bottles and milk jugs and things like that. And then what happens is people leave their bags of materials in front of the bins. So it was an option that was tried.
Is it just a point that where people, I hate to say they're lazy, but is it that they'd get overwhelmed with what they bring? It's just fine to bring all these recyclables, but did they not want to spend the time to apparently put them in? They'd rather just have a big open container, dump it in, and be on their way, and then just hope that it'll all be sorted out in the end, which unfortunately doesn't always happen.
Correct.
That's true. And we're trying to reduce the plastic bags going into the containers because that is the highest contamination for the haulers.
Mm-hmm.
When it gets to the sorting facilities, it wraps around their conveyors. And so that's a charge to us. When plastic bags appear in those containers, we get charged for that. That's a contaminant. So we were trying to avoid that as well.
Well, let's hope that, there's some solution that comes out of all of this that we don't know exactly when it's going to be, but relatively soon, I'm sure, and you would like that as well, to be able to help deal with the problem. But education, learning what can be properly recycled and where to take it and make sure that it gets it's clean and material that can be reused again. There's so many uses for so much out there, isn't there now, that maybe there was back in the 70s and 80s when recycling really got started.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We certainly hope the best for the Lake County Solid Waste Management District in dealing with all this. You know that you have sympathetic neighbors. Like I say, Porter County and other counties are going through the same process, too, of dealing with contaminants and dealing with trash that's dropped off at recycling drop-off sites and the like, and they're having to work with their haulers and taking care of this problem, too. Give us the address, if you will, of the website. If people do want to find out more, find out what can be properly recycled here in Lake County and how they can properly handle it. Give us the website address, please.
It is www.lcswmd.com. So it stands for Lake County Solid Waste Management District.com.
While I have a chance to ask this, we talk about the common recyclables, the paper, the cardboard, the glass, the plastic containers and the like, and cans and those sorts of things that we typically recycle from our residential recycling at home. We talk about, I guess, of course, industrial facilities help out too. They have more specialized recycling. But are there any places or programs coming up or events coming up in Lake County to be able to deal with the things like electronics and batteries and that sort of thing, things that can't go into the regular recycling stream?
Well, our electronics are located in various locations in the county for residents to take their electronics to.
Mm-hmm.
We have 8 locations where they can take their TVs and their computers, their DVD players and PlayStations and such, too. So we don't hold a special event for that. The only special event, not really a special event, is our household hazardous waste event. Which is a traveling event, travels throughout the county during the better weather months for chemical waste collection.
Spent fuels and things like that and oil-based paints and things that really shouldn't go in the trash anyway and certainly
Correct.
Can't go in the regular recycling, to be sure. It's a special material. It has to be specially handled or whatever. So.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's all there on the website. Just go to the Lake County Solid Waste Management District website, and you can find out all the information where you can properly handle and dispose of all of this material that we've been talking about here. And Jeanette and Kira, thank you for spending time with us. And we just, as we say, hope the best to be able to help find some way for residents who are very conscientious about their recycling, now lost another drop-off site here in Lake County, and that we're dwindling in number. And we know that the businesses and probably even industries that were probably taking advantage of finding places to take care of their clean recyclables have lost a home too, I would imagine. Well, Jeanette Romano, who's Executive Director of the Lake County Solid Waste Management District, and Kara Hagerman, who's the Solid Waste Management District's Education and Public Information Programs Manager, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about the problem. Let's hope that there's maybe not a speedy, but certainly a positive resolution that comes out of all of the problems, the trash and the missorted recyclables and everything that just get dumped into the hands of the Solid Waste Management District and the people that are contracted to help handle all this. And we hope that we can have some report in the future about this. Thanks for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you for having us, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I was born and raised in Little Village, Chicago. It's near southwest side of Chicago, inner city, as society likes to call it, urban. So you have gang territories around there. Also like the viaduct bridges that, you know, the trains go on. That's like you're entering an African-American neighborhood. So it's really divided. It's really sad to know that, you know, you're trying to play basketball one day and you can't go to that specific park due to specific gang territories. So unfortunately, you know, it is divided. And sometimes when you cross that border or that imaginary border, you know, you could possibly suffer some deadly consequences. My brother is involved with gangs in Chicago. He has been involved since he was 19. He's the first person I ask for, and he's the first person I worry about, because I know that the things he's doing is really life-threatening. That does paint a negative image to our family as well. I know people like to talk. La gente le gusta el chisme. Y eso me afecta a mí, por my image. Yo quiero parar. Quiero hacer un estudiante. No quiero estar involucrado con gangas. Porque tengo mucha gente que espera mucho de mí. I don't like being called, like my brother's nickname. I don't like being called Lil and his nickname. You know what I mean? It could be one day that you have another gang member and he's just walking around, but I don't even know him. And then somebody calls me that and he's going to assume I'm gang related. And that's something I don't want to go through. That's something I don't want to put my family through either. Although he is really, really, really tough on me on keeping my grades up, going to school, doing the right things. So he's not necessarily impacting me in a negative way. Besides, you know, me worrying a lot for him, he's also motivating me to do better. And my relationship with him is really good, actually. I do carry a weight on me due to the fact of my where I'm from and how I look. I know people like to bring others down and say that they won't achieve the things they're achieving due to the fact that back home you're facing this and you're facing that. So it is a big weight. Y no nada más es el peso de académico de mis grados, pero también es el peso que tengo con la gente en mi comunidad. Yo cargo ese peso porque yo quiero ser successful. Yo quiero agarrar una beca, quiero agarrar mi diploma, quiero hacer una carrera buena. Y a veces eso es imposible porque uno vive mal. Mal como no tiene suficiente dinero para mandar a sus hijos a la escuela. Y yo cargo ese peso porque yo estoy representando nada más a mi familia, pero también estoy representando a la villita Chicago. Porque mucha gente no tiene muchas cosas bonitas que decir. Y yo quiero ser esa persona que digan, bueno, pues Luis vivía en la esquina de la Homan. Ahí ese es un territorio de gangas, pero él de todos modos lo hizo a agarrar sus diplomas. Por eso yo cargo ese peso, porque si un día llega que yo no vengo para atrás a la universidad, pues todo lo que yo estaba hablando se empieza a reducir y gente ya no me conoce y me conoce como un perdedor. Y eso es el peso que yo cargo. That's the weight I carry of my community. I don't want to be a failure. I don't want to let my people down. So the things I do is not only for my family, it's for them as well.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Several organizations and residents put the owners of a controversial large-scale organic dairy in Newton County on notice that they intend to sue in federal court to stop the construction of the facility. Hoosier Environmental Council and the citizens group called Protect Our Kankakee River Basin have strongly opposed the dairy, which purchased the property near Lake Village in February of 2016. Kim Ferraro with the HEC told us late last month why they have filed a 60-day notice of the lawsuit against Natural Prairie Dairy Farm in federal court in Hammond.
Under the Federal Clean Water Act, there is a provision, as with most federal environmental statutes, that allow for citizen suits to enforce the provisions of the Clean Water Act. And before you can bring one, you have to give the US EPA and the state agency here, IDEM, some opportunity to address those violations. And then if the agency doesn't, then you can proceed. So that's what the notice is about.
Now, as I got a way of reminding us of what this is all about, tell us the problems that have developed over time there in Newton County with what the dairy farm wants to do, and why what they want to do is not really good.
This is a very large concentrated animal feeding operation, or CAFO, with 4,350 dairy cattle that will produce the same amount of raw sewage as a town of roughly 300,000 people, so more than the whole population of Newton County. And they're proposing and have started construction of this CAFO right in a very sensitive environmental area that was once a former lake bed of Beaver Lake, which folks probably in the area know was once the largest inland lake in Indiana before it was drained in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And what has been left behind in that sensitive area is a very shallow sand aquifer that is quite susceptible to contamination from the surface. So if pollutants are put on the ground, it very easily seeps into that groundwater, which people rely on for their drinking water. Yeah. And also, that area is being has long been the subject and focus of restoration efforts by the Nature Conservancy, which has restored more than 7,000 acres of native prairie and wetlands, literally right next door to this CAFO site. There's the Willow Slough nature wildlife area very close by. So all of these, environmentally sensitive areas are and groundwater are threatened by putting such a polluting massive facility at this location. What the Clean Water Act citizen suit is about is because we have found out over the last almost 2 years of being involved in this case that Natural Prairie filled, without getting the required Clean Water Act permit, almost a half a mile of Bogus Island Ditch, which is a tributary of the Kankakee River. It was constructed to drain Beaver Lake long ago and provides drainage of the site. And to do that, before you fill ditches like that, you have to get permission from the federal government, and Natural Prairie didn't do that and is now going to be building this CAFO right on top of that filled ditch, preventing any sort of restoration of that mm-hmm. illegal activity. The other thing that has happened is because of the nature of this site, because it was once a lake, it was once a wetland area, under the Clean Water Act recognizes these areas once they, if they were drained originally for farming purposes, for crop farming purposes, you can continue to raise crops in those sensitive areas. But if you change their use, as is happening here, to something else besides crop farming, then you have to get a permit from Army Corps of Engineers in order to fill those, in order to do that activity, in order to further impact that wetland area. And again, Natural Prairie didn't do that here.
It sounds very, very complicated, I guess, but it comes down to basics as whether we can maintain clean, uncontaminated drinking water, because so many people have wells in that area. And exactly. You're not only talking about humans, but you're also talking about animals, because there are farms that are out there anyway that will have to rely on the wells to be able to supply water for their animals. And we got that concern. And, of course, we also have the Kankakee River not very far away, as well as the wildlife areas that are to the south of the proposed farm. So there are a lot of issues that they need to be taken up here, it seems.
That's exactly right. I don't know that I could add anything more to what you just said very well.
Now, how does this procedure, beyond the notice that we're going to file a lawsuit, work? What procedure do you have to go through now in federal court at this point?
Well, as I mentioned before, if IDEM or the federal U.S. EPA steps in and begins an enforcement action against Natural Prairie, then we would be precluded from bringing a citizen suit. We would be able to intervene in any enforcement action brought by EPA or IDEM, but the citizen suit itself would not be allowed to proceed. If, on the other hand, U.S. EPA and or IDEM decide not to proceed with an enforcement action, then we would file a lawsuit in the Northern District of Indiana, Federal District Court, mm-hmm. and we would litigate it as any other lawsuit.
Now, do you get the indication that IDEM, since they have already approved the permit for this work to begin, that they're liable to change their minds about this? Is that likely what they can do, or do they, many of these cases before, as you've seen elsewhere around the state, Kim, that they're not going to jump in and intervene?
You know, I hesitate to speculate what IDEM will or won't do. I will say we've been disappointed with the agency's response to this so far. I'm hopeful that the agency will start to take this seriously, but as you point out, at this point, they haven't. I can tell you that in the past, agencies have brought limited enforcement actions that don't really address the problem as a way to preclude the citizen suit. So simply because the agency, either EPA or IDEM, brings an enforcement action doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to enforce in a way that would actually provide a remedy or provide protection. So we'll still be monitoring. I'm hopeful that the agencies will do the right thing and step up and enforce vigorously. But if they don't, we will intervene in any enforcement action that the agency brings to make sure that happens.
Well, Kim, thanks for the update. We appreciate it. And like everybody else, including the residents in the area around where the dairy farm is being proposed there in Newton County, we'll just have to wait and find out if IDEM or if the EPA decides to jump in and put a stop to all of this. And if not, that's going to turn into the lawsuit that we've already made notice about. It's going to happen, to be sure. Thanks for the update.
Thanks for your interest in the issue.
You're welcome. Kim Ferraro is with the Hoosier Environmental Council. We should note that the Conservation Law Center at Indiana University Bloomington is assisting the Hoosier Environmental Council and to protect our Kankakee Valley Basin in this matter. And Natural Prairie Dairy has stated that it intends to follow the environmental regulations that come with the permit that it has received from the state. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. There are a number of changes that have been made in the city of Gary's Etna neighborhood in recent years, and an activist who ran a project in that community has written a book about it, and we'll talk with her tomorrow.